United States v. Northley. Mr. Hansmeier.
May it please the court. Mr. Hartzler. Dan Hansmeier again on behalf of the appellant, Haywood Norfleet. This is another conditions case. I can begin where we sort of left off in the Siegel, and that's with the CBT program. I'll call it CBT because apparently nobody really knows what the initials mean. It's called something different where we're at. Apparently they refer to it as cognitive-based therapy. Mr. Hartzler says it's cognitive behavioral therapy. I don't know. Maybe that's why when I searched cognitive-based therapy, I couldn't figure out what it was. Maybe I guess I had the wrong word. I guess our concern on this is sort of practical because as a criminal defense attorney, when you're required to advise your client of these conditions and what they mean, it's difficult to do that when you yourself really don't know what it means. And so whatever happens in this case, I think it's valuable that somebody talk about this so that criminal defense attorneys know how to advise their clients, at least. But beyond that, the concern is the government seems to say this is okay because Mr. Norfleet has behavioral problems, and it seems that those behavioral problems essentially just that he has committed a few crimes. And if that's the case, then we've just set up a system in which this program is not a special condition, it's a standard condition. Because every single person that's going to be on supervised release has committed a crime. And so if the program is justified because the individual has committed a crime, then everybody has to do this. And that seems to be a bit of a stretch. For one, if that is what Congress wanted, it would be a standard condition. There would be something in 3583 or something in 5D1.3 that says defendants need to complete this program. So that's our principal
concern. Have you found out what the program, what cognitive behavioral therapy is?
Well, my knowledge is limited to Mr. Hartzler's brief. Whatever he says in there and the links, that's all I know. This still comes up. In fact, last week we actually had an individual, a revocation that came back where one of the violations was his failure to complete this program. So this is not hypothetical. People are violated apparently for not doing this. And I do think in that case, from the client's perspective, he tells us that it would cost $120 to enroll. He didn't have the money, so he didn't enroll. So again, the cost aspect of these programs matter to poor people. And that's particularly why we take exception to them. On the other condition, this mood-altering substances, this is sort of, this court's recent decisions in Adkins and Shannon where there's discussion about having to give a defendant notice of what he can and can't do. And this is our concern with this because there's no definition of it. And without a definition, it's very difficult to advise a client what he can and can't do. And it's just very difficult. And if the defendant were to actually follow this by the letter, he follows the rules like he's supposed to do. He shouldn't be taking substances that alter moods. It's very hard to find. That's what substances essentially do. Common foods alter moods. That's why we eat, snacks in the afternoon so we don't fall asleep. So in our opinion, if this is going to be something courts do, there needs to be some definition. The U.S. Code defines a controlled substance. That's why we know what a controlled substance is. It lists these are controlled substances. If this condition is going to be common, analogous definition would list what the mood-altering substances are. I don't know how else you would do it other than have a list of don't use these substances in this way. But beyond that, what's frustrating about this condition, and it's imposed, it is just imposed. Every case, it's there. Although I will say Judge Myerscough now, at least recently, she has been saying no excessive use of mood-altering substances. I don't know how much that helps. But she has gone away from the complete prohibition to an excessive prohibition. So I guess you can have two energy drinks and maybe not five. I don't know. But it's just, I lost my train of thought. Well, where was I going with this? You may have a question.
I do. Your argument about how this portion of the guidelines is binding,
okay,
really eludes me.
Okay.
I don't get it.
Well, where I'm going with that is simply one of the three statutory requirements that Congress put in place on conditions of supervised release is this idea that conditions have to be consistent with the policy statement. And that policy statement lists special conditions of supervised release. The language in 3583D3 is essentially identical to the language that's in 3582C2. We know that because of the language in 3582C2, the guideline that is applicable to those modification proceedings, 1B1.10, is binding. That's what the Supreme Court tells us. It's binding. The argument is that the language is identical. That's the law. Therefore, 5D1.3 still binds district courts. It's not an entirely complicated argument. The government's response to that was, well, no, Dillon had to do with this idea that there was no Sixth Amendment concern. But that ignores the fact that, as far as I'm aware, that you don't have a Sixth Amendment right to a jury trial to define your special conditions of supervised release. I don't really see how that helps. It seems that Dillon is pretty clear when Congress includes this is consistent with the policy statement language that the policy statement still binds district courts. And our point on that is if 5D1.3 still binds district courts and 5D1.3 lists special conditions of supervised release, then the conditions listed, if there are conditions imposed that are not listed, they need to be consistent with the ones that are listed, or they're inconsistent with the policy statement, and their courts shouldn't be imposing them. I can, if you have any follow-ups. Okay, thanks.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Hartzler. Excuse me. Mr. Hartzler?
Thank you again, Joe Hartzler from the United States. I don't have much to offer an explanation of the cognitive behavioral therapy other than what's in the brief. I mean, you saw the Amazon.
There's no sort of standard Bureau of Prison study or definition of it, or who gives it?
Actually, there is a booklet that I got from the probation office. So there's a booklet that they follow. I don't think it's a public document because it's the company that's contracted with the Bureau of Prisons and the U.S. Probation Office, so it's a proprietary material. But from what I could glean, it's comparable to what we reported in the brief, that it's a therapy program that is designed to make offenders better aware of antisocial impulses and to discourage the negative thinking and antisocial behavior.
Well, has this been certified or approved by some reputable professional association?
I don't know that. I don't know that. You saw that it's been ordered in a list of some cases, not a lot of cases, but there are some reported cases that reference the cognitive behavioral therapy.
But there's no sort of literature on what it is, or as far as you know.
As far as I know, that's correct.
Let me ask you about the mood-altering substances. What does a person do if there's no list? Like sugar, for example.
Uh-huh.
Sugar is mood-altering. So if so coffee is excused, oddly, because coffee is mood-altering. But what if you put sugar? What if you put a lot of sugar in your coffee? That's going to give you a kick.
My recommendation is that this court narrow the definition to psychoactive substances that impair physical or mental functioning. And that's in our brief. And I think we could avoid remand on that issue if this court were simply to define it. And since both Siegel and Norfleet were sentenced, we've had a series of cases. Goodwin came down, but more importantly, for this purpose, Atkins came down. And Atkins is a case that involved a litany of prohibitions, and this court concluded that in order to tweak the definition, that was the term that the court used, would require too much redefining of, there are too many variables. Well, what's the variable here? Mood-altering substance. There's no variable. It just needs to be better defined. I mean, there's no disagreement on that point. And my suggestion is to define it consistent with what the cases and the situations that are that we cite in our brief.
Norfleet isn't a guy who, over his life history, has gone outside the mainstream on his illegal drugs. He stayed pretty much within the usual cocaine and so forth. He's not a designer drug type of guy, is he?
Well, I don't know. I mean, he certainly has an addictive problem. He has a problem with addiction and started at a very early age.
Right, but two pretty conventional things. It's not like he's
things
that have not yet made the controlled substances list.
He has not been convicted of using anything that's not an illegal substance.
Nor does his history show that he's used those things and just hasn't been prosecuted.
The record reflects nothing to indicate that he has used these kind of non-pharmaceuticals or whatever we want to call psychoactive substances. There's no evidence that he's sniffing glue or gasoline or anything of that sort. In the record, right. He certainly is prone to use a lot of different substances and clearly has a problem with addictiveness. So, if your point is, does the record support this condition, I think the answer is that here is a man that if prohibited from using any of the controlled substances, alcohol, the assumption is with his history, he will find something. And various drugs keep coming on the market. I thought Mr. Hansmeier did a nice job when he cited to that website, the drug abuse website that I began by citing to, and he says, well, the potpourri and the spice have now become controlled by executive order. If you keep reading down in that little box, it says, yes, they have, but additional chemical substances keep coming up until there's now something that's referred to as, it's sold as jewelry cleaner. It's called Cosmic Blast. So, you know, the innovativeness of the various people that can come up with mood-altering substances or psychoactive substances is pretty phenomenal.
Is he allowed to smoke?
He will be allowed to smoke if you adopt my definition of mood-altering
right.
substance. He'll
but
also
it's
be able to have
it's,
sugar.
It's, of course, nebulous here. Also, the fact that he's just prohibited from excessive use of alcohol, that doesn't sound right. Alcoholics are told to quit. That you cannot, if you're an alcoholic, you cannot control your drinking. You must quit. You must quit it entirely. So these conditions do not look as if they are designed by people who actually know enough.
Well, I suspect any use of alcohol would soon become excessive use for Mr. Norfleet.
But it's very unfair to him to say, yeah, you can drink. Now, we know it's going to happen. A person like you, addictive personality, you're going to drink excessively, and you violated the condition, back you go to jail. That's not right.
Actually, there's a form for these that the judges will mark, and it's for the special conditions, and it says, prohibited from any excessive, and you check one or the other. And I think one of these five cases.
Yeah, that's in his judgment and commitment, the box is checked for excessive use, not for any use.
Right. And my suspicion is that that was because the conditions of supervised release have been challenged as outside of 3583D and the policy statements. And the policy statements for 3583D, I'm not sure which one it is, refers only to excessive use. So that was probably a protective measure, just to say excessive use, recognizing that this is going to be a problem. Any use is really going to be a problem for somebody like Mr. Norfleet.
Right.
So
now, is the responsibility for designing, recommending these conditions, the special conditions, is this entirely the probation service, or is there some other government agency that deals with these things?
I'm not aware of anybody but the probation office that makes the recommendations, and now in our district puts them into the pre-sentence report as recommendations for sentencing. I mean, if your question is
so, these in the Norfleet case, are these conditions that were actually suggested and drafted by the probation service?
Yes, I believe so. Yes. Oh, okay. If you read the sentencing transcript, I think you'll find that
these were in that a letter that was sent.
That's right.
About the same time as the PSR.
I believe that's correct. Yes. Yes. And then they were discussed at sentencing. There was some discussion as to what the meaning of cognitive-based behavior, behavioral behavior. It wasn't thoroughly spelled out. But could I just take whatever
minute
I have? I'm interested in both this case and in Siegel in avoiding, if we can, an unnecessary remand and resentencing, in part because of the frankly, just the inconvenience and in the cost. So if there's some way that the court can define, let's say, mood-altering substance and simply narrow the definition to what I've suggested, that hopefully will take care of that condition. If there are other conditions, I sense that there's some concern about this cognitive behavioral therapy. You'll find in our brief some definition of it. I think you can see from the history of Mr. Norfleet that he has a problem with substantial antisocial behavior. Some kind of therapy seems perfectly appropriate. So I'm hoping the court will affirm that. But I would hate to see this case go back on just on the supervised release conditions because of the cost of bringing him back for sentencing and the cost of all the parties on issues that won't come into play for close to a decade. And the same, of course, is true for Mr. Siegel.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Hodgson.
Thank you.
Judge Sindra, you said... You asked a question about the relationship between his use of these mood-altering substances and the condition, and you're right, there is no relationship. And that was sort of our lead argument, is that the statute requires a reasonable relationship. There is no relationship in this case. So, and maybe there are clients...
A reasonable relationship to what?
Well, the statute requires a reasonable relationship to the certain 3553A factors. One of those factors is the nature and circumstances of the offense and the history and characteristics of the defendant. And that would allow this sort of provision if an individual has a history of abusing non-controlled substances. That would make sense. There's no history of that here. Mr. Norfleet uses marijuana, essentially. I think there may be some cocaine use. There's no history of anything
else. Well, I think the idea is that if he is deterred from using the control substances, he will look for
right.
The closest substitutes, legal substitutes he can find.
Well, I understand that. Here's my suggestion, and this gets to the modification. If an individual's on supervised release and it comes to the probation officer's knowledge that he's doing something inappropriate with the substance, It's easy. You just modify the conditions of supervised release to prohibit him from doing it. You don't need this catch-all provision that says, don't do this stuff, especially when it causes problems. If it comes about that he's doing something he shouldn't be, modify the conditions. It's that simple. I would note that the CBT therapy, in the government's brief, they note that there is an in-house treatment program. This sort of goes with the sex offender treatment. It's something that can be done in prison. If you can do it in prison, is there a need to do it on supervised release?
Of course, the stresses on supervised release are different. Once the guy's back on the street, he's subjected to a lot of influences. Hopefully, he's not in prison.
Right. Well, that's true, but that goes both ways, as I mentioned earlier. You come out of prison, you have a family to support, you need to work, you have these conditions. It's not a simple thing to worry about all of these special conditions. So I think that goes both ways. And if an individual, if this treatment program actually works and it's available within the Bureau of Prisons, then why not do it there when he has nothing else to do? Get it done then. If he comes out, maybe he comes out and his behavior is still not up to par. Then you modify the conditions and have him do it again, I guess. But this idea that we do this stuff up front without record support, it is the problem. And with that, if there are no further questions.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Hansmeier, and thank you for accepting the appointment in both of these cases.